Great. Thanks very much, Stephen, for the introduction. I spoke at the ABE annual event 2 years ago in December 2018, and in that speech I talked about the lessons and questions from the global financial crisis that had occurred 10 years earlier. Today, the global economy has experienced another crisis, but one which has taken a very different form. The source of the crisis this time has been a health event rather than a financial one. The contraction in output in the global economy and in the Australian economy has been considerably larger and more synchronised than in 08-09. But some of the lessons we learned from the financial crisis have helped to lessen the impact this time around and will help in speeding the recovery that is underway. The lessons that are highlighted in 2018 were firstly, that leverage matters. Secondly, that a timely policy responses are effective. In a crisis, go fast and go hard and don't die wondering. Thirdly, the plumbing can sometimes really matter, so keep the credit pipes flowing. And fourthly, that target policy responses are effective. These lessons are evident today. The importance of a timely policy response is particularly evident. The size and rapidity of the fiscal and monetary policy responses have been unprecedented. The fiscal stimulus provided has been the largest outside wartime in many countries. And this is true in Australia, where the federal government's budget deficit in 2021, in the current financial year, is expected to be 11% of GDP, having been near balance at the beginning of this calendar year. The state governments have also provided stimulus with their budget deficits around 4% of GDP. On the monetary front, policy rates have been reduced where that was possible around the world, often to their effective lower bound. Central bank balance sheets have expanded significantly. While the stimulus has been provided in large scale, some aspects of the policy response have been targeted at particularly affected sectors of the economy. In line with the fourth lesson I mentioned earlier, these targeted measures have been designed to taper as conditions improve or to serve as a backstop should conditions deteriorate. There was one lesson from the crisis I didn't talk about 2 years ago that is relevant today. Be careful of removing the stimulus too early. A number of European countries learned this lesson to their cost after the global financial crisis. That leverage matters is evident in the post-financial crisis reforms to the financial system. The Australian and global banking systems came into the current episode in a good position. Banks are holding more capital and have much stronger liquidity positions. Banks were at the centre of the financial crisis in 2007. In contrast, banks were not a catalyst to the financial tumult back in March this year. Banks have strong balance sheets that are able to support the economy through the downturn and into the recovery. Examples of this are in their ability to offer loan deferrals, as well as the capacity to make provisions for future loan losses without compromising capital. Banks with strong balance sheets can lend to businesses and households to support the economic recovery, rather than being concerned with restoring balance sheets, as has been the case in previous cycles. The strong capital buffers of the banks are there to be used, not preserved, and this point has been clearly stated by APRA. This leads to the third lesson, keep the credit flowing. The actions of central banks to stabilise dislocated markets also had that as one of the primary motivations. In many countries, including Australia, central bank bond purchases help stabilise government bond markets that serve as the key pricing benchmark for the global financial system. This was particularly so in the US, where the treasury market is a pivotal foundation of global financial markets. The one question I posed at the end of my 2018 speech was how much debt is enough and how much is too much. I said that the question remained generally unresolved, but in the case of public debt in Australia, there is a very clear answer. In Australia, public debt is very manageable. Public sector debt remains low as a share of GDP for the Australian government, as well as the states and territories, even after the sizable stimulus that has been implemented that you can see on the picture here. Australian governments have been able to provide the substantial and very necessary fiscal support to the economy. It is also important to ask, what is the alternative? Absent the fiscal support that's being provided, the Australian economy would be much weaker, with the consequent economic and social damage. And this would have materially worsened the fiscal position. So I don't see there as a trade-off between fiscal sustainability and fiscal support in the current circumstance. The cost of borrowing is at historically low levels for Australian governments. Their borrowing costs are likely to remain very low for quite some time, and almost certainly until the economy is considerably stronger. This means that the debt dynamics for the Australian government and the states and territories are absolutely sustainable. In the rest of my talk today, I will summarise the policy actions that the RBA has taken since March to support the Australian economy. I will describe how they have been transmitted to the economy and financial markets so far. First, I'll just quickly recap the actions the board has taken to date, which are summarised on this slide. In mid-March, as the impact of the virus and the health policy actions on the Australian economy became evident, the board put in place a comprehensive package that had a few elements. First, a reduction in the cash rate target to 25 basis points, having already reduced the cash rate to 50 basis points at the earlier March board meeting. Second, the introduction of a target on the three-year Australian government bond of around 25 basis points. The bank would purchase bonds to address market dysfunction. Third, a term funding facility for the banking system under which funds can be provided for 3 years at 25 basis points. Fourth, the continued use of the RBA's open market operations to make sure that the financial system had a high level of liquidity. The RBA had already been expanding its liquidity provision prior to this board meeting, to the March board meeting, the mid-March board meeting, that is, to address the growing dislocation in financial markets. And finally, the modification of the interest rate corridor system with the rate paid on exchange settlement balances set at 10 basis points. In September, as the deadline for drawings on the initial allowances under the TFF approached, the board decided to expand the TFF to provide additional low-cost funding equivalent to 2% of lending in the bank, in the banking system. Then, at the most recent November board meeting, the board decided on a further package of measures to support the Australian economy. First, a reduction in the cash rate target, the three-year yield target, and the interest rate on new drawings under the TFF to 10 basis points from 25 basis points. Second, a reduction in the interest rate on ES balances from 10 basis points to zero. And third, the introduction of a program of government bond purchases focusing on the 5 to 10 year segment of the yield curve, and announcing that the RBA will buy $100 billion of government bonds over 6 months in the secondary market, purchasing bonds issued by the Australian government as well as by the states and territories. The motivation for these policy actions is to provide support for the Australian economy. It is complementary to the necessary and welcome significant financial stimulus provided by the Australian government and the states and territories. Its aim has been to deliver low borrowing costs for households, businesses, and the government. These low borrowing costs are a necessary precondition to support investment and spending as confidence in the health and economic outlook improves. In addition, the monetary policy response boosts the cash flow of households and corporate borrowers by lowering their debt servicing costs, which more than offsets the effect of the reduction in interest income on deposits. Asset prices are also supported, which bolsters balance sheets of households. Finally, the lower structure of interest rates leads to a lower exchange rate than otherwise. All of these channels of transmission boost aggregate demand in the economy and hence employment. I will now step through in more detail how these policy actions have been transmitted through Australian financial markets to the Australian economy. First, the reduction in the cash rate target and the remuneration on ES balances has seen all short-term interest rates decline to historically low levels. This decline has been further accentuated by the large amount of liquidity in the financial system as a result of the bank's policy actions. The large increase in liquidity was initially provided in response to the heightened demand at the bank's daily open market operations. Subsequently, this has been bolstered as banks have drawn on their allocations to the TFF. Given the ample liquidity in the system, including the significant take-up of the TFF, as those earlier liquidity injections in March and April matured, they have generally not been rolled over. And that's what I'm showing on this graph here. You can see the initial large boost in liquidity for our domestic market operations in March and April, and that's gradually rolled down as those earlier liquidity injections have matured, but you can see that it's been more than replaced by the take-up of the TFF. As a result, the size of the RBA's repo book from our regular market operations has shrunk considerably, but the total of repos under the TFF and market operations remains very large, generating a large amount of system liquidity. The liquidity in the system has been further increased by the bank's bond purchases. When the bank buys bonds, there is an increase in ES balances as the bank credits, as we credit the ES accounts of the counterparties that we buy the bonds from. The large rise in ES balances has seen the cash rate fall to be close to the interest rate on ES balances. That's what we're showing here is the cash rate, BBSW, and the expected future par for the cash rate. Up to October, you can see the cash rate was trading for a number of months around 13 basis points, a little above the ES rate of 10 basis points. The small difference between the two reflects transaction costs and a small credit premium. Now that the ES rate has been reduced to zero, the cash rate is currently around 5 basis points. OIS rates have declined in line with the cash rate and around 4 basis points for the foreseeable future, reflecting the market's expectations that the ES rate and the cash rate will not be increased over that horizon, consistent with the bank's forward guidance. The combination of the low cash rate, low OIS rates, and the ample supply of liquidity and funding in the banking system has seen BBSW decline to low single digits, just the red line on the graph here. The cash rate and BBSW are critical pricing benchmarks for many borrowing rates in the economy for both households and businesses. The final monetary policy driver of borrowing rates in the economy is the three-year bond yield target. The bank has chosen to focus on the three-year bond yield target for a couple of reasons. It influences many borrowing rates across the economy, given that borrowing rates in Australia are variable or fixed for short horizons, particularly compared with other countries such as the US, where the 10-year government bond rate is a more important pricing benchmark. Secondly, the three-year horizon is aligned with the forward guidance on the cash rate. The board has stated that it will not increase the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably within the target range of 2 to 3%. Given the outlook for the labour market and the economy, the board does not expect to increase the cash rate for at least 3 years. The combination of ample system liquidity, the low ES rate and low cash rate, the three-year yield target and the expectation that policy rates will remain low for at least 3 years are underpinning low borrowing rates right across the economy. So let me turn to talk about how this is being passed through to borrowing rates for businesses and households. So firstly, in terms of business borrowing rates, you see here, we've got the data on the average rate paid by small, medium and large businesses. So there was a step down in business borrowing rates following the policy package in March that you can see here in the middle of the graph. And borrowing rates have declined further since. In addition, corporate bond yields have declined as credit spreads have reverted to pre-pandemic levels and the risk-free benchmark curve has declined. There has been subdued bond issuance by banks because of the significant increase in funding from deposits as well as the TFF, and this has contributed to a further compression of corporate spreads as fixed income investors look for other bonds to buy. After the surge in drawdowns of credit lines in March and April for precautionary reasons, business credit has declined as these credit lines have been repaid. And despite the low cost of borrowing, demand for new business loans is subdued. Nevertheless, when businesses become more confident about future prospects, the low cost of borrowing will support their decision to invest. Turning to mortgage rates, there was a marked decline in fixed rate mortgages in March that you can see here on the graph, the light blue line. You can also see that the decline in standard variable rates has been less. However, the average mortgage rate paid by households has continued to decline as households have continued to refinance and take advantage of the low mortgage rates on offer. And this is shown in the new loan rate line here, the brown line, which is still noticeably below the average rate paid by households. So the average rate paid by households is the purple line on the graph. The average new loan rate is the brown line, and then the fixed loan rate is the light blue line. And you can see they're all still on a downward trend. We expect the steady decline in the average mortgage interest rate paid by households to continue for a while yet. These declines in mortgage rates have boosted the cash flows of households with mortgages. The early super withdrawals also provided a sizable boost to cash flows. At the same time, household incomes have been boosted by the support through the Job Seeker and Job Keeper programs. And these have all contributed to a very large increase in household savings, which has been further bolstered by the constraints on household spending through the period. As a result, there has been large increases in offset accounts and redraw facilities for those with mortgages. And this boost to household saving and cash flows will help support consumption in the recovery. The transmission of lower mortgage rates to household borrowing has differed between owner-occupiers and investors, as you can see on the graph here. So this is credit growth to owner-occupiers and investors. Credit growth to owner-occupiers is around 5%, which has been supported by federal and state government incentives for new home building. Investor lending has been declining up until recently, in part reflecting expectations of lower returns given weaker rental demand. The decline in the cash rate and the increased liquidity in the financial system has also led to a decline in deposit rates. Those who benefit most from lower mortgage rates tend to be younger, while those who depend on interest income are generally aged over 65. So back, the most recent data we have, which is back when the cash rate was at 1.5%, around 5% of these older households were earning more than 1/5 of their income from interest. Hence, the effect of monetary easing falls unevenly across the community, although so does the incidence of unemployment. That said, the impact on the household sector in aggregate is clearly positive. While a low interest rate environment can put pressure on banks' net interest margins, the return on equity of the Australian banking system remains robust. Moreover, it is important to remember that there would be an even bigger effect on bank profitability from increased loan losses that would occur if the economy were weaker and the stimulus had not been provided. Let me now turn to talk about the bond purchases by the RBA, and they are comprised of three elements. So what I show here is our bond purchases to date in AGS and semis relative to issuance since the beginning of the year by the semi, beginning of March at least, by the semis and by the Australian government. So there are the three elements of our bond purchases are, firstly, purchases to maintain the three-year yield target. Secondly, purchases to address market dysfunction. And third, since November, the $100 billion bond purchase program. So in March and April, the bank bought bonds across the maturity spectrum out to 10 years to address the dysfunction in government bond markets. And we purchased both AGS and semis. So you can see those particularly steep increases in purchases in March and April at the beginning of the graph here. Since early May, we have not needed to do any more purchases to address dysfunction, but the bank stands ready to resume these purchases should dysfunction return. We have also purchased bonds to maintain the three-year target as required. Up until mid-October, the target bond was the April 2023 bond maturity. Now the bond with maturity closest to 3 years is the April 24. Since early November, we have purchased $5 billion of the April 24 bond to meet the objective of maintaining the three-year yield around 10 basis points. In November, the board announced a quantity bond purchase program that is complementary to the three-year yield target. So why did the board decide to do this? First, longer-term Australian government bond yields were higher than those in other advanced countries. This provided some evidence that the size of central bank bond purchase programs was affecting longer-term yields beyond the anchoring effect of the RBA's three-year yield target. This in turn was contributing to a higher exchange rate. So why didn't the board just extend the yield target to a longer horizon? First, the yield target reinforces and is very much aligned with the bank's forward guidance on the cash rates. 3 years is a reasonable horizon over which we have some confidence about the economic outlook. Beyond that, the economic outlook is considerably less certain and with it, our confidence about the settings of monetary policy. Second, further out along the yield curve, other factors also start to have a greater influence, and particularly global developments. And the recent volatility in longer-term bond yields resulting from news about vaccines is a case in point. So what has been the impact of the expectation and announcement of the November package? Recent movements in bond yields and the exchange rate provide some evidence. So since mid-September, there are increased market expectations of a further decline in the cash rate, the exchange ES rate, and the three-year bond yield target. And there are also expectations that the bank would announce a quantity target for bond purchases. And as a result, there was a decline in yields at the front end of the Australian curve, but there was also a decline in longer-term yields that was larger than the decline in shorter-term yields. Showing here the spread between AGS and bonds in the UK, Canada, New Zealand, and the US, and the spread between Australian government bonds and those of these other advanced economies clearly narrowed from around about mid-September through until November. And this provides evidence that the quantity of bond purchases has an influence above and beyond the price, particularly in terms of net demand, that is, how much the central bank buys relative to issuance. And finally, at the same time as we saw this narrowing in spreads relative to other countries, the spread of semis to AGS also declined. Between then and early November, the exchange rate also depreciated by around 5% in trade-weighted terms and against the US dollar, and is reasonable to attribute the bulk of this depreciation to the growing expectation of the package that was announced in November. Longer-term yields have risen a little since the November board meeting, as has the exchange rate, largely due to the news about vaccines, but I would argue that they are both lower than they would be absent the November policy package. Finally, let me remind you briefly about how the bond purchases occur. So the bond purchase program comprises $80 billion of AGS and $20 billion of semis. And any purchases to maintain the three-year yield target will be in addition to this. The bank buys the bonds in the secondary market. We announce our intentions at 11:15 on Mondays and Thursdays for the AGS bond auctions, both for the three-year target and the bond purchase program, and on Wednesdays for semis. The bond purchase program comprises bonds beyond the three-year yield target up to the longest maturity in the 10-year futures basket. And we alternate purchases each auction between the shorter and longer end of that maturity spectrum. And for the semis, what we do is we purchase them across three auctions with the aim of buying broadly in line with the size of the respective bond programs of the states and territories. So having announced it in the morning, in the afternoon, we take bids in a five-minute window on the auction platform, and we accept the bids that are cheapest relative to the mid-market price for the relevant bond. And so that determines the final composition of the bonds we purchase each auction, with the caveat that for the states, we're aiming to achieve an overall allocation that's consistent with the size of their bond programs. And then the results of the bond auctions are published very shortly after they are completed. We are carefully monitoring the impact of these bond purchases on the market, and we're definitely alert to any sign of dysfunction in the market and are prepared to adjust the program if necessary. So let me finish up in terms of monetary policy in 2020. So the RBA has implemented a comprehensive package of measures over the course of the year. This package has materially lowered the structure of interest rates in the Australian financial system. It has lowered borrowing costs for households, businesses, and the government. And the decline in interest rates across the yield curve has lowered the exchange rate relative to what it otherwise would have been. This package of monetary stimulus is complementing the significant fiscal stimulus by the federal and state governments. It has boosted the cash flow of households and businesses as the effect of lower borrowing rates has more than offset the impact of lower deposit rates. And this directly supports spending in the economy, as does the lower exchange rate. The lower borrowing rates will encourage businesses and households to borrow, invest, and spend when they are confident about their future prospects. While the news about vaccines is very welcome and should help bolster that confidence, the recovery will be uneven, and it is likely to be some time before the vaccines will be widely available and distributed. That said, the fiscal and monetary support will boost spending in the economy as it recovers. This will increase employment and in time reduce unemployment. A materially lower unemployment rate is clearly desirable in and of itself, but it also will be necessary before we will see sustainably higher wages growth and inflation. So thank you for listening, and that provides a summary of an eventful year in monetary policy. And Stephen, very happy to take questions from there.
Oh, thanks, Guy. I think a very thorough and well-timed summary of the bank's actions this year, certainly been an extraordinary year. So thank you for that. So as I mentioned at the outset, Guy's going to take some questions from the audience. So I notice we've got a few already, but Guy, I'm going to ask you a sort of a personal question up front. I was at Governor Lowe's speech last week, and he was asked about when was the moment this year when he really realised this was pretty serious. And he nominated when he was at the G20 meeting in Saudi Arabia. So I'm going to ask him the same question. When did you realise the seriousness of this crisis?
Well, the question's already been answered for me, right?
Well, you could have a different answer.
I mean, the same time, I think, really. I think that was when it became clear that it was much more all-pervasive. Sometime around about then. I said, I can't remember exactly. It's a bit like the financial crisis, although even more recent this time, but it's still a bit of a blur that period. But I would say, yeah, sometime around about that point. Certainly just prior, which is not far before we had our board meeting in the middle of March.
Okay, thank you. There's a question from Justin Farbo from Macquarie Bank. So what probability would you put on the risk of an extended period of strong asset slash housing price growth? You mentioned that during your speech, given the guidance that you've given again today, that interest rates won't be going anywhere for quite an extended period of time.
Thanks, Justin. I mean, there's a few dynamics going on in the housing market at the moment, and it's quite different across the different parts of the market, both in terms of higher density versus detached, and also around different parts of the country. And some of the developments are affected by the government support that's being provided too. I mean, in higher density stuff, there's quite a bit of supply coming on the market, and a decent chunk of what people who otherwise would have occupied that aren't turning up. A fair chunk of that market was, at least in aggregate, was to students and Airbnb or short-term business visitors and the like, and they aren't here. So we've got much lower population growth over the next couple of years than would have been factored into people's assessments when they were building those places. So, you know, the dynamics there in the short term, at least, is more supply coming on the market and not a hell of a lot of people to live in it. Or if they don't, or if they live in that, then there's going to be the places they're moving out of are going to find it hard to find someone to fill those places. And so we've seen a decline in rent. And so the investor part of the market, particularly in the medium high density side of things, is quite soft. On the other side of the equation, the detached market is actually doing pretty well, particularly on, you know, now living on the outskirts of big cities is a good thing rather than a bad thing. And so the demand for that is quite reasonable. So we're seeing these different dynamics across the country, but given the underlying supply demand dynamics, I don't see it being too much pressure on house prices in the short term. If I look at equity prices, they've gone up here, but not as much as they have, say, in places like the US. And then there's also the question, if you're in an environment where interest rates are structurally low for a long period of time, and we've been in that environment for a while, but it looked like we're staying in it for a while yet, then in that world, you would expect asset prices to be higher. We've moved the policy rate lower, but some of that reflects structural factors which are going to be with us for a long period of time and which would underpin higher asset prices.
Thanks, Guy. Another question here from Deanna Messina from AMP Capital. What else do you think the Australian government should do in terms of policies, if anything, to assist the domestic recovery?
Well, I mean, the government's just announced their budget in October. You guys, New South Wales government, have only just announced their budget in the past week, and the Victorians have only announced their budget today. So I think let's see what's happened from what's been announced first before we still start worrying about what more that should be done. I mean, as I said, a lot of this stuff has just been announced recently. We'll just have to see how that takes effect, but also how the economy evolves, because there's still a large amount of uncertainty in both directions around the outlook for the economy.
Thank you. There's been a couple of questions about the legislated increase in the super guarantee, the compulsory super guarantee. For those of you who saw Paul Keating on 7:30 last night, there was quite an animated discussion. I know your boss has a view on this. I'm wondering what your view is. Do you share his view?
I don't think I need to jump into this debate. I think there are more than enough participants in this debate at the moment.
Okay. There's a question from Danny Davis. What do you see as the Reserve Bank's role in the recovery beyond the usual levers in lifting systemic capacity, productivity and resilience? I'm sort of guessing I know what your answer is going to be, is that's a matter for government, but perhaps I'll put it out there anyway.
I'm not quite sure what role there is for us beyond, as I said, we're doing what we can to provide support for the recovery as it takes hold. But you know, there's only so many things we could do in that space. I think we are doing what we can do in that space, but I'm not sure there's much further role for us to do any more than what we already are doing.
No, fair enough. There's a question here from Patrick Commons, journalist. How important to the recovery is the announcement that the Queensland border will reopen to Sydney and Victoria from December the 1st?
I don't know. I think it's better that it does open up more opportunities. I'm just not sure I could put a number on it. I mean, it allows, you know, I would say people in far north Queensland are probably fairly happy about the prospects of at least domestic Australian tourists being able to get up there now, which would have been somewhat constrained before now. So at least for some of those communities, I'd say be pretty beneficial. I mean, the flow of goods has been by and large not too affected. It's really been travel and tourism and service flows, which have been the ones that have been most disrupted by the state border closures. The goods cross-border flow has not been too disrupted.
No, okay, thank you. I've had a question sent through separately by text, so I'll ask that one. It's from a journalist. If government bond yields around the world were to, say, double next year from their current levels, particularly in the US, and normalisation of economic growth as vaccines control COVID, what would be the RBA's preference in terms of extending or increasing its bond buying at the long end? Or would it prefer simply to maintain the three-year bond target?
So if the economic outlook changes, then that changes our assessment of the appropriate stance of monetary policy. But I think we've got to wait and see whether the economic outlook changes. Bond yield target is focused on the three-year point to keep borrowing costs low, because most of our borrowing rates in the Australian economy, as I talked about earlier in the speech, are anchored around that. Much less keys off the longer end of the curve beyond obviously the borrowing rates of the federal and state governments.
Thank you. There's a question here from Tapas Strickland at NAB. You mentioned in your speech about in a crisis, go fast, go hard, don't die wondering. Is there another lesson from the GFC, perhaps was withdrawing stimulus too early, which you mentioned? What's your view on balancing the risks of keeping policy too low for too long against committing to the forward guidance, e.g. the three-year yield curve control?
I've lost the last bit of the question. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, sorry. What is your view on balancing the risks from keeping policy too low for too long against committing to forward guidance?
We're looking over the horizon. We don't see much of a risk of have inflation too high or unemployment too low. So I don't see that there's much of a risk, at least on the just confining remarks purely to monetary policy, of there being too much of a risk of that in the foreseeable future. I just don't see that over the sort of three-year horizon that we've got any degree of confidence over.
Okay. Your boss, again, has been quoted several times, and you probably have as well, Guy, about negative interest rates in Australia being extraordinarily unlikely. Why is the bank so committed to not having negative interest rates? Is the reason unique to the Australian banking system? Or Governor Lowe mentioned a couple of reasons last week, but I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
I know there's a reason. There's some research out there which shows that they're effective. I don't find that research overly convincing. And at least talking to some of my colleagues in other central banks about some of the research that they're doing and some of the things that they're seeing, you know, which is not in the public domain, and I concede that, but that's at least I draw some, you know, put some weight on what they tell me, is that they don't see that they're being overly effective. So I do know that there's some literature out there which says that they are effective, but I find in terms of, certainly in terms of supporting the flow of credit, I don't find the evidence all that convincing. And talking to some of my counterparts, they note that. And they also note the behavior of some parts of their economy in terms of, their household sector in terms of saving more rather than saving less as their lower rate, because of the lower rate of return on savings. Now, you know, from a theoretical point of view, you might say that that's, you know, not sensible, but that's what happens. Or that's what's happening in some of these other jurisdictions. So at least some of my assessment is informed from what I get from talking to my counterparts around the world in terms of what they are seeing. These are the places with negative interest rates in terms of the sort of responses that they're seeing.
No, thank you. There's a question from Sophia Rodriguez. So you mentioned in your speech a materially lower unemployment rate. She's asking if you can put a number on that, and maybe I can maybe just extend that question to say, where would the bank be comfortable that we've reached an equilibrium point for the labour market and perhaps inflation?
I mean, I think that's a question of just seeing how we go. I mean, it's lower than here, so I'm comfortable in absolutely comfortable in saying it's lower than where we are now. We also know that prior to this, with an unemployment rate of around 5, we weren't really getting any material upward pressure on wages and prices. Now, you know, it's conceivable that the structure of the economy has changed a bit over the past 6 or 9 months. Bit of evidence to that effect. So we may not be going back to exactly the same world that we were in at the beginning of this year. So I really think that's a question of just seeing how it goes. But whatever it is, it's a fair bit lower than where we are now.
Yep. Fair enough. There's a question from Rob Henderson here, who's on the ABE committee. So the RBA has been at the forefront of analysis of China's economy and its impact on Australia. Given the current trade friction, how does the RBA expect Australia's net export to proceed? And to what extent is this trade friction a threat to Australia's economy?
I think I'll just, there's plenty of political discourse around that at the moment. Again, I don't think I need to throw myself into the provide my opinion on that.
Okay. There's another question here from Justin Farbo, and I think it's a follow-up. I think I know the answer, but I'm going to put it out there anyway. So you mentioned interest rates probably won't move within the next 3 years. I think you said at least the next 3 years, but presumably if there's an early vaccine, our borders open up, growth recovers, then the Reserve Bank would be at least open to considering an earlier normalisation?
Well, I mean, we'll just see what happens. I mean, at the moment, so first of all, well, it looks like we're getting more and more positive news on the vaccine each day, which is great. Then people have to get the vaccine. And then it's not just Australians have to get the vaccine, but other people have to get the vaccine before we open up our borders. So, you know, and I think the other point to remind people of, it's not growth, which we've got to remember about levels here. So we've had the largest decline in the economy in a long period of time. So, -7%, -8%. So growth rates can be strong, but not get us back to the previous level. So at the moment, I think we didn't think we'd get back to the previous level of GDP where we were at the beginning of this year for sort of 2.5-3 years. So, or at least a couple of years, sorry. So, you know, we've got to get back to where we were first, and then we've got to back to be where we otherwise would have been before we're anywhere getting close to what would be a desirable outcome. So, I mean, I suppose the bottom line in all of that, there's a hell of a lot of uncertainty out there, and we've just got to see how all that plays out. And you know, it's much better to be sitting here speculating about a positive turn of events rather than a negative one. But at the same time, I just point to what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere and particularly in Europe, where output's going backwards in the December quarter. Here, at least, we're going to have a decent outcome over the second half of the year. But in Europe, they're going backwards, having not even anywhere near come out of regained where they were before they went into all of this. So just pointing out, you know, that yes, it's good that there's positive news out there. It's hell of a lot better than the alternative, But I think we've got a bit of a way to see how all this all plays out.
Okay, thank you. There's a question from Michael Potter. What does the RBA see as the potential future path of the current account? Do you see any likelihood of Australia running an ongoing surplus, potentially reducing or removing our net foreign debt?
I think my last speech pre-pandemic was on this topic from memory, something like that. Anyway, I look at it more from the savings investment side of things, and we've seen a large increase in household saving. We're not seeing a hell of a lot of investment at the moment. It'd be nice if we saw more. So corporate savings actually fairly high. On the other side, obviously the government's running a sizable budget deficit, an appropriately sizable budget deficit. So we'll just have to see how all that plays out. But at least prior to this, we'd run current account surpluses for a while. And it was conceivable that they were going to continue for a while. I mean, we may see a world where the household savings is a bit higher structurally than it was prior to this. That's plausible. I'm not quite, to some extent, the critical swing factor here is going to be on the corporate side. Is business investment, which hadn't been particularly strong coming into this episode, how strong is that going to be over the period ahead? Corporate savings is actually in a reasonable position at the moment. The question is, are they going to invest? And I think that's probably going to be the major determinant of how the sort of saving investment balance and hence the current account evolves over the period ahead.
This is a related question, Guy. It's from Danny Davis. What are your general thoughts on the benefits, risks of increased liquidity in the Australian economy arising from strategies that increase foreign capital inflow as opposed to locally generated stimulus strategies?
We've been a net capital exporter, the flip side of the current account surplus for the last couple of years. So, I mean, we have large pools of domestic savings here, some of which are invested locally, some of which are invested offshore. And at the same time, we draw on some foreign pools of capital as well. I mean, I don't think I have a strong view as to which of those two is more desirable. If we've got viable investment projects, it's good that someone's willing to fund them. I think in the end, that's the bottom line, regardless of where that funding's coming from.
Okay, thank you. So a question from Julia Balazs, and what are your thoughts on significant tax reform to encourage investment in Australia? And perhaps I can put out a personal element to that as well. What about the announcement last week of an intention to move away from stamp duty in favour of broader land tax in New South Wales?
I mean, I think the New South Wales government did a reasonably good job of laying out a path towards moving away from stamp duty. To some extent, now is a good time to do that when your borrowing costs are so low, so you can take the hit to the short-term hit to the deficit, even if you make that, and I think your numbers show that you make that up over time, but that's a reasonable horizon. But at the moment, you can sort of afford that possibly more than any other time in history. I mean, in terms of broader government tax reform, again, that's not my area of expertise. I'll leave that to the tax experts.
No worries. I will make this the last question, Guy. So it's from Hassan Tevfik. And recently, a US FOMC member suggested that QE has been more effective in stimulating financial markets than the real economy. Do you agree? I'm not sure who he's quoting there, but do you agree, and can we again have a situation where the benefits of QE are narrowly distributed?
So I think there's a couple of things to bear in mind. As I said, so I think if you look at what, and you can just use the recent experience we've had here. So since we've announced the bond purchase programs, yields have come down and the exchange rates come down. The exchange rate coming down absolutely boosts domestic demand, and that puts people in jobs. And the biggest way of affecting economic outcomes is whether people have jobs or not, which I think is sometimes lost in this discussion. So higher asset prices is part of the transmission mechanism. That's true. But so is, but in the overall aim here is to stimulate aggregate demand, and that gets people in jobs, and that has the first order impact in terms of economic outcomes across the community. So I think that's one thing we've always got to keep in mind. So as I said, if you, at least I take comfort from the fact that since we've started down this path over since November, we have, or in, at least in anticipation of us going down this path, we've seen the exchange rate come down by a noticeable amount and enough to have an impact on the economy and have an impact on employment and people's livelihoods.
Thanks, Guy. So, look, we'll close things there. So, look, Guy, thank you again for your speech. Very much appreciated by the ABE and, of course, by our audience, and also for taking all those questions. I wish you and other senior members of the RBA all the very best in helping to navigate the Australian economy through what remains, I would argue, an ongoing economic and health crisis. So thank you again. Thanks to everyone online today for your engagement as well. Please keep an eye out for upcoming ABE events. This is our last event for 2020, but of course we have another year approaching, and of course our annual conference is in February as always, so please keep an eye out for advertising on that. We'll have a great array of speakers, including some drawn from the executive committee of the ABE, so look out for those. But for now, thanks again for participating. This is our final event for the year. As I said, it's been an unusually challenging year for all of us, but I wish you all a very productive end to the year and hopefully a restful summer. And I'll see you all again in 2021. But for now, wish you a very good day. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen.